KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Donald Trump, in his more than 1 hour and a half speech to Congress Tuesday night, touted his executive action since taking office 6 weeks ago and said, "We're just getting started." Among actions he mentioned were the federal hiring freeze, creating the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, headed by Elon Musk, and renaming Denali to Mount McKinley in Alaska. Since taking office in January, tribal leaders from across the country have been raising concerns about the administration's actions. The hiring freeze and the mass firing of government employees with the help of DOGE has tribal leaders worried about essential services in tribal communities, saying there could be devastating impacts, including to healthcare, education, and public safety. Last week, tribal leaders from across the country and leaders of Native organizations testified during hearings in Washington on American Indian and Alaska Native programs in a subcommittee in the House Committee on Appropriations. In his written statement to the subcommittee, President of the National Congress of American Indians, Mark Macaro, said the Trump administration's early actions have generated confusion, fear, and real consequences throughout Indian country. Tribal leaders who testified urged for exemptions for tribes from Trump orders and for the federal government to uphold trust and treaty obligations. According to the Subcommittee of Interior, Environment, and Related Agencies, a third day of hearings was needed to accommodate around 100 tribes and tribal organizations. The action changing Denali to Mount McKinley prompted the Alaska State Legislature to urge the administration and the U.S. Board on Geographic Names to maintain the name Denali. And U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski introduced a bill that would officially designate the mountain as Denali, its Koyukon Athabascan name. During his address, President Trump, when talking about the war in Ukraine, referred to Senator Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas, which he uses as a jab at her. Tribes and Native groups have condemned Trump's use of the name, including the National Congress of American Indians. In 2017, NCAI said the name of Pocahontas should not be used as a slur, and it's inappropriate for anyone to use her name in a disparaging manner. Native women's advocates say it hurts the image of Native American women, adding the name is used by some as a stereotype for sexualizing them, pointing to Native women facing high rates of sexual violence and assaults in the U.S. A bill in the New Mexico legislature seeks to help address missing Native Americans in the state with a new alert system. According to the New Mexico Department of Justice, Native people account for 16% of missing persons in the state. Reporter Jeanette Didios has more.
Senate Bill 41 passed the Senate unanimously Saturday and would amend the Missing Person Information and Reporting Act to include a turquoise alert for Native Americans who are enrolled in a federally recognized tribe and go missing. An alert would go out immediately across the state without having to wait the standard 48 hours for a missing person. The bill is sponsored by Democratic Senator Angel Charlie, who is Laguna and Diné. Democratic Representative Michelle Paulina Beta, who is Diné from Tehachapi, is a co-sponsor. She says in her large rural district, it can take law enforcement a long time to respond to emergencies.
And I'm not talking a few hours, I'm talking days. And when someone goes missing or someone's endangered, we need these alerts to go out right away.
The bill passed with an amendment that refines the criteria for issuing an alert to high-risk cases. It's now in the House Government Elections and Indian Affairs Committee. The bill would require the Department of Public Safety to develop a plan for getting alerts out to law enforcement and the public. This bill does not include a direct appropriation, but a fiscal analysis states there may be recurring costs for state agencies to implement the alert system. At least three other states, including Washington, California, and Colorado, have passed similar legislation in recent years. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
We're trying to come out with a win-win-win document where everybody gets a little bit of a win.
A new draft of the House Education Funding Bill includes some compromises. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 5th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a massive avalanche kills three heli-skiers near Girdwood, and King Cove residents cheer President Trump's position on a proposed road to Cold Bay.
It was a little bit of a surprise, but a pleasant surprise.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning. With reporters covering every corner of Alaska, you can be sure you're up to date on the stories that matter to Alaskans. Join me, Ava White, for Alaska Morning News, weekdays on your local public radio station.
Local sponsors do right by their business and for the community by supporting public media stations. Thank you for considering adding your corporate support. You'll be in good company.
Alaska state troopers say three heli-skiers were caught in an avalanche yesterday near the ski resort town of Girdwood. Initial efforts to recover them were unsuccessful because they were reportedly buried under at least 40 feet of snow. The buried skiers are presumed dead and have not been publicly identified. Troopers said the avalanche caught the skiers, who had flown with Chugach powder guides to a remote area about 8 miles northeast of Girdwood, at about 3:30 p.m. Tuesday. The Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center reported considerable avalanche danger in the area at elevations above 1,000 feet. Poor weather conditions prevented troopers and avalanche experts from reaching the site today to assess whether it was safe enough to resume recovery efforts. Meanwhile, avalanche forecasters are concerned about additional heavy snow. Andrew Schauer is the National Forest's lead avalanche specialist.
You know, as I look out the window, it's snowing hard in Girdwood right now. So we're just adding more snow and more weight on top of this weak snowpack. And even after this storm passes, conditions are going to remain dangerous because that weak layer exists. And we're just adding more stress and making the avalanches potentially bigger now that we're adding more snow to it.
Schauer says several other groups skiing in the area triggered avalanches Tuesday and were not caught. According to the Alaska Avalanche Information Center, the state's last avalanche that killed three people occurred on Bear Mountain near Chugach in February of 2021. Schauer says the tight-knit local ski community was feeling somber about the three fatalities.
We're really feeling for the operators and for the families and friends of those people involved. And at the same time, we're all concerned, looking for the next few days and weeks ahead. We're just really hoping that people pay attention and are willing to use mellower, lower angle terrain because we're dealing with this dangerous snowpack.
Schauer encouraged backcountry users to access the forecasts and observations for the area, which are available at ChugachAvalanche.org. Boosting Alaska's energy sector was a priority among President Donald Trump's executive orders on his first day back in office. The list of projects he supported included opening drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and reinstating support for the Ambler Road. But one item seemed out of place, a road from King Cove to Cold Bay's all-weather airport. The Alaska Desk's Theo Greenlee reports.
The gravel road out of King Cove hugs a narrow strip of land between the tundra and the shore. Across the water, you can make out the buildings of the city of Cold Bay. The road dead ends about a dozen miles away, but Trump's executive order means that it eventually could continue on to those buildings. King Cove City Administrator Gary Hennig says he was caught off guard when he read the order.
It was a little bit of a surprise, but a pleasant surprise.
Air travel in and out of King Cove is notoriously difficult. Harsh weather and a short gravel airstrip combine to make medical evacuations a big problem. Residents argue that an 11-mile road to Cold Bay and its much longer all-weather runway would save lives by providing reliable access to Anchorage's medical services. But conservationists have opposed it for decades. The road would cut through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge, which dozens of conservation groups and Alaska tribes say would upend decades of conservation law in Alaska. Rob Rosenfeld is a consultant for many of those tribes fighting the project, and he says the road has to be stopped.
Compromise is not an option in the case of one of the most fragile ecosystems in the world. The habitat revolving around the eelgrass is incredibly fragile.
Eisenbeck supports one of the largest eelgrass beds in the world, critical for geese populations that migrate through the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. And the Federal Interior Department would have to swap a section of the refuge land with King Cove to make the road possible. Critics like Rosenfeld warn that the land swap could weaken the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, more commonly referred to as ANILCA. They say that would set a dangerous precedent.
This means that all refuge lands, all ANILCA lands, all designated wilderness, and even national park lands are vulnerable to the whims of changing administrations.
A road has never been built through conservation lands under ANILCA. And land exchanges under the Act typically require congressional approval. Ian Dooley is an attorney with Earth Justice, one of the organizations opposing the land swap.
This would be the first land exchange under ANILCA that would allow for giving away, divesting protected lands out of a conservation system unit for the purposes of putting a road through that conservation system unit.
Dooley represents the native village of Hooper Bay, located hundreds of miles from Eisenbeck in the Yukon-Kuskokwim River Delta. Now, they've taken a central role in the fight against the road because those eelgrass beds are critical habitat for several species of geese, which Hooper Bay residents rely on for subsistence.
Nearly the entire globe's population of these two populations of birds rely on both Eisenbeck and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta for different parts of their life cycles.
Edgar Tall Sr., the tribal chief of the native village of Hooper Bay, says threatening those geese would impact his community's way of life.
We only rely on seasonal subsistence because 80 to 90% of my community do not work. So they only rely on subsistence to survive.
But Dean Gould, the president of King Cove's Native Corporation, says the road is also crucial to their ability to access their subsistence lands.
If the road to Cold Bay was there, we'd be able to use them a lot more often, because right now you have to, if it's nice, you take a boat, or then you got to get in the skiff and all that, and not too many people have that capability.
Gould is hopeful the project will go through this time, especially since former President Joe Biden's administration also endorsed the project near the end of his term. But Gould is wary, given past federal flip-flops.
It seemed like we're more on of a positive note, but we've been there before, too, also. So one second you're smiling, and next one you're holding your breath.
The decision now rests with the Department of the Interior. King Cove officials are waiting to hear from the secretary or deputy secretary on next steps. In Unalaska, I'm Theo Greenlee.
State House leaders unveiled a revised high-priority education funding bill today ahead of a floor debate in the full House tentatively scheduled for Monday. The bill includes a $1,000 increase to basic per-student funding for public schools next year. But it leaves out further increases and inflation proofing, which were in earlier drafts of the bill. Instead, it includes a number of policy provisions that House lawmakers hope will be enough to avoid a veto from Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy. House Majority Leader Chuck Kopp, an Anchorage Republican, says he's glad to see the bill take a step forward.
Progress is real and inspiring on education right now. It is fragile and incomplete, but we're moving forward.
Boosting state funding for public schools is a top priority for the largely Democratic bipartisan coalitions that lead the state House and Senate. Caucus leaders have said repeatedly that they're pushing the education bill on an accelerated timeline in an effort to provide certainty to school districts currently working on their budgets. The first draft of the bill included no policy reforms, but Dunleavy has said repeatedly that he won't sign an education funding increase unless it's paired with reforms aimed at boosting student performance. The bill includes a three-year trial of a statewide open enrollment policy. It also includes incentive grants to school districts tied to reading proficiency similar to those proposed by Dunleavy. Ahead of the bill's release, House Rules Committee Chair Louise Stutes, a Kodiak Republican, said leaders were hoping to find a deal everyone could get behind.
We're trying to come out with a win-win-win document where everybody gets a little bit of a win, whether the House, the Senate, the administration, the governor.
But where the governor stands on the bill at the moment is unclear. His communications director declined to share the governor's thoughts on the bill this afternoon. The bill could run into roadblocks in the Senate, too. The chair of the Senate Education Committee said today she was skeptical of the open enrollment provisions proposed in the House. And Senate Majority Leader said Tuesday they were not sure the state's deficit-ridden budget could support a $1,000 increase in basic per-student funding and senators' desire to pay a roughly $1,400 permanent fund dividend. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Sitka nonprofit is fundraising to rehire fired Forest Service trail crews.
These are folks in need of jobs, and we're going to create opportunities and put them back to work doing what they love.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
As part of ProPublica's local reporting network, KYUK senior reporter Emily Schwing spent the last year crawling through attics, basements, gear closets, and classrooms in rural public schools across the state. She found chemical leaks, standing raw sewage, extensive black mold, exposed electrical wiring, and malfunctioning fire alarms. There are 128 open rural schools in Alaska. Just under half of them are owned by the state, and many of them are falling apart. KYUK's Emily Schwing dug through state data and found decades of neglect and lacking accountability that's put students, teachers, and staff at risk.
Most school districts in Alaska have access to money that doesn't come from the state, but rural school districts are different.
We do not have any local contributions. We do not have a tax base. Most of our community members, our families, they live a subsistence lifestyle.
Madeline Aguilar is the superintendent of the Cusbuck School District, which includes Sleep Mute and eight other schools scattered across 12,000 square miles. It's roughly the size of Maryland. Without a tax base, Aguilar says her district is almost entirely reliant on state funding to help pay for everything from textbooks to sewer lines.
The state does have an obligation to provide a public education, you know, in the Constitution for the state of Alaska to the students in our region. And I would think and I would hope that providing that education would also mean assistance with providing the physical space.
Since 1998, rural school districts have made nearly 1,800 funding requests to the state to replace sewer lines, heating systems, roofs, and a host of other projects. Only about 14% of those projects actually received money. According to an analysis of data from the state's education department, at least 135 rural school projects have waited for state funding for 5 years or more. 33 of those projects have languished on the state's funding list for more than a decade. Each year, urban and rural school districts submit hundreds of requests for money from the state to help pay for their maintenance and construction needs. The education department ranks those applications and gives that list to lawmakers to help them make decisions about how to fund the state budget. Because it's a competitive process, school districts have to prove their project is worth funding. Since 2021, Madeline Aguillard says her district has spent more than $200,000 on engineering and architectural inspections to beef up SleepMute's application.
We've jumped through the hoops, we've filled out the applications, we've gotten those in.
SleepMute is one of 128 rural public schools operating in Alaska today. The state owns just under half of those buildings. After years of rejection, some school district administrators have turned to lobbyists to help drum up support during the annual legislative session. This means Madeline Aguillard's school district is paying tens of thousands of dollars each year to convince lawmakers to invest in a building that the state owns.
I identified we have a major problem. Not only the life and safety concerns that, you know, these professional engineers, these architects are telling us, they're putting in writing, they're signing their name to it, but I had to do something. And so I knew our story needed to be told, and our story needed to be told as loud as possible to everybody that would listen to us.
And it's not just a problem in Aguillard's district. In Venati, a village 30 miles north of the Arctic Circle, exposed electrical wiring hangs close to flammable insulation. Thorn Bay, on an island in southeast Alaska, has requested money to replace its fire sprinklers 17 times without success. And in the Bering Sea coastal village of Neutauk, the school's pipes froze and broke. So for most of the last school year, kids rode a four-wheeler known as the bathroom bus home twice a day to relieve themselves.
I think the evidence speaks for itself.
Alaska House Speaker Bryce Edgman was in SleepMute in October, where he toured the school, met with teachers, and talked with students.
And these bright young children show up every morning to go to school in a building that's not fit for even anything but being ready to be demolished.
An analysis of data from Alaska's Education Department shows that in at least 20 cases since 1998, funding requests were on the state's ranked list of projects for so long that cheaper repairs evolved into proposals to tear down and replace schools. In total, those projects cost the state tens of millions of dollars more than what it would have cost to fund the original repairs. The Department of Education's own regulations say the state is responsible for any major maintenance and construction for buildings it owns. But Alaska's Education Commissioner Dina Bishop says it's not that simple.
That means, we're responsible according to the amount of funds that we can invest in that, so that the funding for those projects comes from the state of Alaska's legislature that would provide funding for those positions. And then our job is to support those districts in executing them.
Bishop acknowledged small rural school districts are struggling, but she says her department can only work with what the legislature allocates to education each year.
Our state has many needs, and there's lots of different stakeholders from around the state that do a great job of sharing their need. And then it's our legislators who have to balance Alaska and what is it that we need? Is it roads? Is it clean water facilities? Is it sewer? And we also play a part in that. But our needs are met along the lines of the entire state.
This year, requests for investments in school infrastructure statewide come close to $800 million. Rural school district requests account for more than half of that. That kind of money just isn't available, according to Bryce Edgman.
No, we don't have the financial needs, unfortunately, to put a big sort of Marshall plan, if you will, towards modernizing all these remote, smaller schools that are far-flung areas of Alaska.
Last June, SleepMute finally got some good news. The governor signed off on the largest one-time increase to education funding in Alaska in nearly a decade. It included money to fix SleepMute's leaking roof. But left unchecked for two decades, the building requires more than a roof repair. The foundation is crumbling, there's water damage in the ceilings, and black mold throughout the interior. Madeline Aguillard says the money isn't enough to fix everything.
This is what happens when it is too little and it comes too late.
Angela Hayden's been a teacher in SleepMute for 17 years. The school's roof has been leaking the entire time.
So, like, when I come in the building, especially after, like, a lot of rain or a lot of snow, I just think, okay, what am I going to have to deal with before I can deal with my classroom?
When she does come into her classroom to teach kids every day, it's business as usual.
Like, this is a big deal to the state, but as far as our day-to-day operations, like, we're going to keep going. We're not going to let it devastate us.
In Sleep Mute, I'm Emily Schwing.
Support for this reporting comes from ProPublica and the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's 2024 National Fellowship, its Fund for Reporting on Child Well-Being, and the Dennis A. Hunt Fund for Health Journalism.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education. Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to health care in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Alaska's State Development Agency is ending a two-decade partnership with the operator of the Ketchikan Shipyard. Vigor Alaska's agreement to operate the multi-million-dollar state facility and major Ketchikan employer is now set to expire at the end of November. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, better known as ADA, told Vigor Alaska in a four-page letter that the company had not brought enough business to the shipyard. The letter from ADA Executive Director Randy Ruaro also cites what the agency says are inadequate contributions to repairs and upgrades. The move came as a surprise to local officials, says Ketchikan Gateway Borough Mayor Rodney Dial.
We were initially a little shocked, but you know, we know that there are some significant repairs that are needed at the facility. There was discussions between ADA and the facility regarding repairs and also productivity and growth of the facility.
The news also came as a surprise to Vigor, according to a spokesperson who defended the company's record operating the shipyard. In a statement, Vigor's public affairs director said the company had invested millions of dollars in the facility. He said ADA's decision threatened nearly 100 full-time jobs in Ketchikan and that there was no clear successor to Vigor. State House Representative Jeremy Bynum, a Ketchikan Republican, says he's hopeful the transition in operators will not lead to large job losses in the community.
There's a lot of uncertainty with the current Vigor employees, but my hope would be that in any transitional plan that there would be a clear pathway for a short transitional period that would have a very minimal impact on our Ketchikan workers.
Though Vigor's agreement to operate the Ketchikan shipyard expires at the end of November, ADA says it's open to negotiating an extension through next March to ease the transition. Whether that's enough time to find a new operator to take over the industrial facility is unclear, but Doug Ward, a former Vigor executive and the namesake for the shipyard's assembly hall, says he's optimistic.
We have some very capable operators in the state that are Alaska businesses and would make outstanding operators of that Ketchikan shipyard.
The shipyard was originally built by the State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities in the 1980s. ADA acquired the facility in 1997 and contracted with Alaska Ship and Dry Dock to operate it in 2005. Vigor assumed operations of the shipyard in 2012. A local nonprofit in Sitka is picking up the slack in the wake of the mass federal firings that began a couple of weeks ago. Sitka Trailworks hopes to put at least four of the five members of the Sitka Ranger District's cabin and trail crew back to work this season. A fundraising campaign has already generated over $100,000. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
When the Forest Service fired the entire cabin and trail crew for the Sitka Ranger District in February, Many people may have thought that it wasn't a tough loss, as they were only seasonal workers. But the cabin and trail crew, like many jobs in the Forest Service, is a different kind of seasonal work.
These guys come back year after year because they have this permanent status in a seasonal position where they don't have to apply again. And that means that the Ranger District invests in their training, and they usually bring quite a bit of skills to the job.
Ben Huey is the executive director of Sitka Trail Works, a local nonprofit which supports the Forest Service with public outreach programs like trail and cabin surveys, and with volunteer work parties to assist with local trail maintenance. Huey admits the unskilled but energetic crews that Trail Works puts in the field are no replacement for the recently fired Forest Service team.
The trail crew leader had a background in construction as a contractor, and so he was out there milling lumber in the backcountry and building bridges. There's a beautiful new bridge on Salmon Lake that was completely constructed by this crew. They do small structure construction when you're building new outhouses, and they're skilled arborists, so cutting down hazard trees, overhanging scary stuff that I wouldn't touch, and learning explosives, so getting the even more hazardous obstacles out of the way of our trails or cabins sometimes takes really technical work that we as Sitka Trail Works can't just take volunteers out and do.
But what Trail Works can do is raise money, and in just a couple of weeks, they've raised $106,000 in donations. The purpose is straightforward: to put as many of the Forest Service crew back to work as possible for as long as possible, maintaining the federally owned resources around Sitka that residents enjoy and pay for, both with taxes and user fees. Huey says putting displaced workers back to work is in the DNA of Sitka Trail Works.
Sitka Trail Works was founded when the pulp mill closed in the 90s to keep families in town, to provide job opportunities, doing something that gives back to the community. And so we're going to do that again. These are folks in need of jobs, and we're going to create opportunities and put them back to work doing what they love and doing what the community needs.
But it's only a stopgap. $100,000 raised in a couple of weeks is significant, but it's not a long-term solution. The Forest Service and U.S. citizens have made a considerable investment in public lands over the years, which no amount of nonprofit fundraising can match.
Sitka Ranger District has several support staff for these crews. Mm-hmm. They have multiple boats. They have access to airplanes, a huge shop and tools and resources that we really can't fundraise for locally. Like, the capacity in our community to just everybody's chipping in just doesn't get to the amount that the Forest Service invests in these public lands. We're pushing as hard as we can to get one season.
Huey says the ultimate goal is to preserve the public's access to resources that would otherwise suffer if the expertise and skills of the Sitka Ranger District's trail and cabin crew were eliminated along with their jobs. Reporting in Sitka with help from Aaron Fulton, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Theo Greenlee in Unalaska, Eric Stone in Juneau, Emily Schwing in Sleep Mute, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Annie Fite produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night. Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Once there was this kid who got into an accident and couldn't come to school, but when he finally came back. His hair had turned from black into bright white. He said that it was from when the cousin smashed his soul. This girl who wouldn't go and change with the girls in the change room, and when they finally made her, they saw birthmarks all over her body. She couldn't quite explain it, they'd always just come directly home right after school. In the wind, they went to their church. They shook and lurched all over the church floor. He couldn't quite explain it, they'd always just gone there.
Creeping around in my head, be holding you down in my head. Wisdom Street. Break the glass and throw away the key. Somewhere where the fates collide. Cigarettes and kitty line. I sit here in the lone cafe. So stripped away, so stripped away.
vampires walking through the valley. Move west down Ventura Boulevard, and all the bad boys were standing in the shadow, and the good girls were home with broken hearts.
There's still I want them back.